In the summer of 2014, more than 100,000 Central American children and families were caught trying to enter the U.S. illegally. Those numbers fell after the U.S. asked Mexico to strengthen its southern border. But now there are concerns over the possibility of a renewed surge. I'm Virginia Alvino, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Newly released numbers from the Department of Homeland Security show that this past October, the number of unaccompanied minors from Central America almost doubled compared to the year before. Why the resurgence and what can the U.S. do about it? Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio has a two-part special report updating Central American migration from El Salvador.
The line of the hopeful forms every weekday morning at the American Embassy in San Salvador.
Hay miedo, mucho peligro en las calles, donde quiera que vayamos.
There's fear in the streets wherever we go, says 31-year-old Antonio Turcios. He wants to enter the U.S. legally, so he's here for an initial interview. Thousands of other Salvadorans don't bother. Neither do others from Central America's Northern Triangle, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. They just go.
Por lo menos a escapar de la realidad dura que tenemos acá en El Salvador.
To escape the reality that we have here, says Turcios. That reality? Well, here's Alberto Arena, former chief of the Salvadoran federal agency that runs the country's airports and ports. He says gang warfare unfolding here is playing out across the region.
Now these countries are trapped in a vicious circle of murder and economic and social stagnation.
Last year, a two-year truce fell apart between two enormously powerful regional gangs, Calle 18 and Mara Salvatrucha, also known as MS-13, both founded in Los Angeles. They emerged in the 1980s when Salvadorans fleeing a civil war fought off attacks by Mexican immigrants in L.A.
Nos han matado hermanos, miembros contrarios.
That's Roberto, an unapologetic member of Calle 18 in a prison near the port city of La Libertad. He won't give his last name. He says when one of your gang brothers is murdered or maybe a rival, well, things happen.
Somos dos bandos los que estamos bien grandes, tanto...
We're two gangs so large that we control where the government doesn't. He's in prison for weapons offenses, where members of one gang are separated from the other.
Es un temor bastante grande que tal vez las personas tienen hacia nosotros.
People fear us. In reality, we're not out to hurt people, he says. We're just fighting amongst ourselves. The truth? Well, Salvadoran media and police report that both gangs kill bus drivers whose bosses won't pay extortion, they kill passengers on those buses, and that they murder police each other and innocents who make the mistake of crossing into their territory. In the first 10 months of this year, El Salvador reported nearly 5,500 murders, much of that attributed to these gangs, or maras in Spanish.
It's part of the symptoms of what was going on in the country. If the people had work and if the people had future, why? Why do they have to go to maras?
Don Pepe Simán's the scion of one of Salvador's prominent business families. He says the 12-year war that ended in 1992, well, it really never ended, and it never addressed the poverty that spawns crime.
They signed the peace accords, but they didn't follow the peace accord. The signing of the peace accord was political and military, was an economic. So people learned to use guns.
And some of that learning took place in the U.S. In 2013, close to half the Salvadorans deported from the U.S. back to this country had a criminal record. They've joined local chapters in El Salvador of whichever gang they belong to in California, Arizona, and Texas.
Para el combate frontal.
Salvadoran Congressman Jose Santos Melarde Yanes is a security specialist in the FMLN, the former guerrilla force whose leader is today El Salvador's president. Melarde wants the U.S. to help fund a full-scale attack on organized crime here.
Las pandillas y el narcotráfico se mueven en Centroamérica.
Gangs and drug trafficking are all over Central America, Melarde says. And now the gangs are heavily armed with weapons of war, he says.
Que ahora están armados, muy armados, con armas de guerra.
And partly as a result, a new surge. In fiscal 2015, 140,000 Central Americans have been detained trying to enter the U.S. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is now warning of a, quote, looming humanitarian crisis in the Americas. I'm Lauren Madelon in El Salvador.
The United States is spending millions on public relations and aid programs to convince Central Americans to stay where they are. But the PR campaign doesn't appear to be working. Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio continues his special report from El Salvador.
There's a popular song playing on the radio here. Many people don't know it's part of a U.S. government PR campaign in Central America.
Migrantes de todas partes se atrincheran entre los rieles, muy lejos de donde vienen, más lejos de a donde van.
Migrants everywhere entrenched along the rail ties, far away from where they come, further away from where they go, the lyrics say. The words harshly describe a series of trains called La Bestia, the Beast, that bring migrants from southern Mexico on their way north.
La Bestia del Sur le llama.
The song details how migrants are preyed upon on their journey by a Salvadoran gang known as MS-13, founded in Los Angeles. The lyrics also dispel a myth, namely that children who arrive will be granted U.S. residency.
Que hoy sea más fácil que nuestros hijos consigan papeles en el norte es falso.
That's just not true, the woman says. But the PR campaign is apparently being trumped by the facts on the ground. A call comes in. Police in downtown San Salvador, the capital, rush out. Someone's reportedly been attacked in a neighborhood police say is gang-controlled. The detective in the car asks that his name not be mentioned. He fears retribution from one of the two gangs that control large parts of this country. We're in an uncontrollable situation, he says. The word gangs is a label that belies the highly structured groups that they are, say Salvadoran police. They not only demand extortion, they also judge and sentence people to detention or death, and they decide where people can and can't live, in effect a parallel state. On this run, combatants and their reported victim have scattered. The police leave the scene. Later that day, well, here's Carlos, an MS-13 member. He won't give his last name. We are who we are, from the streets, he says, in a prison where inmates from MS-13 and their main rival, Calle 18, are separated. Staring at a cinder block wall, he echoes the gang's public mantra, a challenge to the Salvadoran government. They could listen to us, make the people at the bottom of society count for something.
What we export mainly is people and not goods and services. We have to turn around that equation.
Economist Alberto Rena is the former head of SEPA, the Salvadoran agency that controls the country's airports and ports.
We have to assume our own responsibilities.
Many gang members here have been deported from the U.S. with criminal records. Police here say that's led to a rise in violence. But Arena says it's both simplistic and unfair to blame the U.S. for the current insecurity in El Salvador.
That's a wrong approach, because a lot of the economic and the political elites of this country have done a very poor job in this post-war era.
But Arena also believes Washington could really help out Salvador and neighboring Guatemala and Honduras by making one change.
When the United States deport people that have been involved in illegal activities, violent activities, it's very important that at least they will share the record with the national authorities of these countries for people to know who are they receiving. This hasn't been done.
But even if they locked up criminal deportees here, where would they put them? At a prison that only houses gang members, a lieutenant in the National Police says, just look at this situation.
Las cárceles de nosotros ya están saturadas.
Our prisons are jammed, he says. The lieutenant also asked that his name not be used.
La mejor manera de ayudar a nuestro país es esa. Puede invertir en nuestro gobierno, en los programas sociales.
The best way to help our country would be investment by the U.S. government in social programs, he says, adding that might succeed in convincing people that they can actually stay in Central America.
El problema no ha sido nuestro, ha sido el de ellos.
This problem started in the U.S., not here, the lieutenant says. The Obama administration has proposed a tripling of aid to the region. 80% would go to civil society and economic development. Congress will vote on that request no later than December 11th. I'm Lorne Madelon in El Salvador.
Texas has filed suit against the federal government and a nonprofit refugee resettlement group in its effort to block Syrian refugees from coming to the state. In the suit, the state alleges that the U.S. government and the International Rescue Committee violated federal law by working to resettle two Syrian families expected to arrive in Texas soon. It also argues the groups did not consult with or provide information to state officials as required by their contractual agreement. The state wants to stop more Syrian refugees from entering its borders without explicitly being informed and having those refugees thoroughly vetted. In Dallas, an airline incident has some immigrant organizations talking and wondering. Last Monday, Dallas City Plan Commissioner and attorney Bobby Abdahi was kicked off a Virgin America flight from New York to Dallas. The attorney sent a text to the Dallas newspaper saying a gate agent pulled him aside and said the crew did not feel comfortable having him on the flight. That story from KERA's Christopher Connolly.
Abdahi was on his way home from a vacation in Bermuda. The Dallas lawyer told Good Morning America he was shocked when a gate agent at LaGuardia Airport in New York told him he would not be allowed to fly.
At the beginning, I thought it was just kind of a joke, and I was on some reality TV show. But as reality started to set in and people who were boarding the plane are staring at me, I just really felt like I was out there on an island by myself.
The decision came after Abdahi and a flight attendant struggled through a revolving door on their way into the airport. In an email, a Virgin spokesman said the flight attendant's arm was pinched in the door and called it a regrettable personal misunderstanding. The airline has apologized. Abdahi, who was born in Iran, told the Dallas Morning News he wasn't sure if race played a role. Virgin has said it did not. Ibrahim Hooper from the Council on American-Islamic Relations says people who are perceived to be Muslim are often profiled on flights, especially after terrorist acts like the Paris attacks 2 weeks ago.
Everyone's in favor of increased airline security. We all fly. We want to be safe. We want our families to be safe. But our safety and security has to be based on real things, on real evidence of potential wrongdoing, not merely on perceived religion or ethnicity.
Abdahi ended up flying from LaGuardia to DFW on American Airlines. Virgin offered him 2 free flights with its apology. He sent them to the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas, which helps immigrants and people seeking asylum.
That was KERA's Christopher Connolly reporting. Coming up on Fronteras, we'll hear how a student who got in trouble changed her attitude about police officers.
I didn't like any type of police officer. Like, no matter who, what police officer was, at that time, I did not like them.
That story, and we'll explore Texas Jewish history after this. I'm Virginia Alvino, and this is Fronteras. Sometimes teenagers who get in trouble can get a bad impression of police officers. In Houston, there's a program that puts students and officers together to learn more about each other. As Laura Eisensee of Houston Public Media reports, it's changing attitudes on both sides.
When Stephanie Mosquera got into serious trouble on campus, she was sent to an alternative high school. There, she enrolled in a mentoring program with police officers called the Teen and Police Service Academy, or TAPS, where she met Sergeant Anthony Turner.
The first day when we come in and say, you see me in this uniform, what do you think about me?
Trying to put us in jail, looking for any type of reason to get us in trouble even when we're doing literally nothing. I didn't like any type of police officer. Like, no matter who, what police officer was, at that time, I did not like them.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Not just because of my experience with them, but because of my family's experience with police officers. Like, my brother and my dad, like, how they got arrested a lot. And they told me stories about how police officers would act unfairly with them and stuff. So, and then I even had my own experience with them, so my perspective on them was really bad.
But what about some of the things, like, your peers say? You know, like, some of them in class, they would call us 12.
They'll call you an op. Yeah, that's the most famous words for police officers. Op is the opposite of, like your enemy. Mm-hmm. It's like your enemy.
So, yeah. Opposition. Yeah. But, you know, most of us, we're pretty nervous when we meet y'all. When we get in there, we really don't know what to expect. Sometimes y'all are too playful. Sometimes y'all don't want to talk. Sometimes we have to force it out of you. And a lot of us, we don't like to speak in public.
It was, like, I believe 5 weeks into the program is whenever my perspective on them changed a lot. A lot.
Was it something that we said or just you being around us?
Y'all really helped us whenever y'all kept telling us, like stuff that y'all didn't like giving us basically, like, advice on how to act when we approach police officers. The police officer would actually give us time to explain our side of the story if we got into, like, a little problem. When that happens, I'm just like, y'all not going to believe me. Mm-hmm. Whatever y'all do, you're going to take me to jail. Mm-hmm. That's automatically what I had thought, but whenever y'all had told us that the reason why we take us to jail is because we automatically get so pumped up about it because of our perspective on the police officer.
Because your attitude, you know, we let y'all know that your attitude kind of dictates the situation. That if you can have a positive attitude and you can show the officer respect, that the officer will respect you back. But also I learned from you. I learned the fact that as a police officer, I had to understand that when I come, you see my uniform. And not only do you see my uniform, but the way I speak to you is maybe not what I say, it's how I say it. You know, so I might tell you, sit down, and you might think, you know, you might feel like I'm saying, sit down. Yeah. But just because of that authority figure. But it, maybe if I can lower my voice and not make myself seem so threatening, that we can communicate better. You can say, okay, maybe he wants to listen to me.
You trust me?
I do trust you.
Okay, good. I trust you.
I trust you enough. You can call me if you need some advice. But it's just one of those things that we had to work on. I know one thing that I wanted to ask you. What about, like, now after being in the TAPS program and you see all these things over the news or on social media, like, how does that make you feel about police officers?
Like, when I see people talk about police officers on social media, like, I really get upset. I mean, there are some times where I'm just like, wow, like, that police officer is really in the wrong.
You're right.
That still does not change my perspective on, like, the ones I have met. I was like, there are still some good police officers out there. Mm-hmm. If you automatically think, like, all police officers are bad, you're going to treat all of them bad, and they're all going to, like, come at you bad because of how you approach them first. Like, mm-hmm. you just have to give them a chance.
You, Stephanie, you know, I want to say thank you for even being open enough to give myself and the other officers the opportunity to get to know you, for you to teach us, and for us to be able to share some of our experiences with you.
Thank you.
That was Stephanie Mosquera, a senior at Waltrip High School, and Sergeant Anthony Turner with the Houston Police Department's Homicide Division. I'm Laura Eisensee.
On Sunday evening, the Jewish Festival of Lights, Hanukkah, begins. The holiday commemorates the rededication of the Holy Temple and honors the time when a one-day supply of oil lit the temple menorah for 8 days. Jewish scriptures are recorded on scrolls called the Torah, and one Austin community now has two historic ones. The scrolls, along with a 19th-century synagogue, came from a disappearing Jewish community in Brenham, Texas. KUT's Veronica Zaragovia has more on the history of Judaism in Texas.
Since they arrived in Texas back in the 19th century, Brian Stone says Jews wanted to fit in. Stone teaches history at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi.
They accommodated to some extent to the culture of the place they came to. And if that means boots and hats, you know, and a drawl, they'll pick that up.
I recently told Stone that as a Jew from Miami, I'm used to yarmulkes and flip-flops. But when I recently saw Jews in cowboy hats, I thought, oy vey. We're standing outside of Austin's newest synagogue. It's actually more than 120 years old. It came from Brenham, moved here in three pieces on the back of a truck. They rebuilt it on Austin's Dell Jewish Community campus, where a ribbon-cutting ceremony took place in August.
Ask them to cut the ribbon, and once they're inside and have a moment to put the Torahs into the ark, we'll begin our Torah. Woo!
Leon Tobin is in the crowd. He's 87 and remembers what it was like to pray in here as a kid.
When I went in by myself and I sat down and I looked around and I remember where my father sat, where my grandfather sat, where the rabbi sat, and the different members that I were relations of mine, it was special.
Back in Brenham, he and his wife were its only remaining caretakers. The rest of the congregants moved away or died off. The Tobins made a painful decision to move the white wooden synagogue out of Brenham to a place where it could thrive again.
This celebration of a new birth of Judaism here is touch. It's something I never dreamed of. I thank God that it happened.
It's certainly unusual. Synagogues rarely get saved for their original purpose when the congregants are gone, says Brian Stone. He wrote the book The Chosen Folks, Jews on the Frontiers of Texas. Stone says Brenham isn't the only historically Jewish community to decline and eventually disappear.
We could mourn the loss of small Jewish communities, but then that's a lot to mourn because there's a lot of them and there are very few left, not just in Texas, but all over the country.
Towns across Texas got most of their Jewish residents when they moved here in the 1800s. Most came from cities like New York, New Orleans, and Charleston. From 1907 to 1914, a wave of Jews came directly from Europe through Galveston. Hollis Ava Weiner is a Texas Jewish historian based in Fort Worth. She says Jews quickly adjusted to life in Texas.
We have in Tyler, there was a rabbi named Solomon Greenberg, and he saw that his neighbors were smoking hams, so he smoked kosher turkeys.
He started in the late 1930s. Today, the business he started, Greenberg Smoked Turkeys, still exists in Tyler. Another example is in Marshall, Texas. Jews used to have a synagogue there built in 1900. Its sisterhood raised money to build an annex in 1939 by selling Mabel Stein's hot tamales.
Instead of, let's say, something Jewish.
Corsicana still has a synagogue from the 1890s that has twin onion domes. It's on the National Register of Historic Places, but it's now a public space for everybody.
When people visit Corsicana, they know, without even reading about it, that once this was a center of a strong Jewish community.
Meantime, back in Austin, the Jewish community here has quintupled in the last 30 years. Brenham's loss is Austin's gain. Orthodox Jews here now have a synagogue to use, the one moved here from Brenham. This month, the building will see its first wedding in more than 75 years.
That was Veronica Zaragovia of KUT in Austin. And that's it for Front Data. Send our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. And Charenga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I am Virginia Alvino at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for joining us.